tell us about faith, faith, and physics and chemistry. He got his degrees at St. Francis Xavier University in Western, and then spent time at San Diego and Tokyo for an
But thanks, Cliff. The title was changed today. I was just trying to figure out what the audience and what might interest. And I'll talk about cells today, not so much about singularities, although they tell me that the Pauli exclusion principle breaks down in the singularity, so I've been told. So Cliff also said I was going to explain the origin of life from first principles, so we'll see at the end of the talk where and tied into quantum gravity, of course. Anybody have any chalk? So as Cliff indicated, I'm at McGill. I'm in a sort of a schizophrenic position, shared equally or unequally between the departments of physics and chemistry. And in the overview, I know in terms of it's actually a pleasure to be here at the Perimeter Institute, seeing so much in the media about this place. It's actually really, really great to come here and to see such a wonderful, I would say, intellectual playground. Fabulous, fabulous place, and I'm really enjoying my day. In terms of this colloquium, I was told, Cliff told me that you've had previously speakers in different areas, ranging from stem cells, etc. I'm going to talk about a general problem of looking at how cells adhere and migrate. This is important in aspects, for example, of cancer, metastasis, when adhesion breaks down, when cells invade new tissues, and actually trying to move it to a quantitative footing, to do quantitative measurements in living cells and also in neurons. And to do this, we've developed a series of techniques called image correlation spectroscopy techniques, which is basically a way of measuring various things inside cells in terms of transport processes based on measurements of fluctuations in the system. So I'm going to sort of explain the various techniques that we've developed and put them in context and then show some of the latest results for measuring this phenomenon of migration and adhesion in cells, transport measurements in cells, and specifically related to adhesion receptor movements inside the living cells that regulate this process. I'm then going to, later on in the talk, depending on time, focus on a couple other things. We also work with nanoparticles in terms of using them as probes for looking at transport molecules inside cells. We're using luminescent quantum dots and studying them in cells, but there are some properties of the quantum dots that make them particularly tricky for pulling out measurements and aspects of their luminescent behavior and power law blinking. And we have also variations on the techniques which work in reciprocal space, which have advantages for working with these things. And then maybe at the end, depending on time, some things we're doing with nonlinear microscopy for imaging in intact tissue, neurons, and things like that. So sort of overview of the talk. But because I know that people here deal with things different from cells and stuff, I wanted to sort of set the broad picture of what we're interested in, how we go about looking at it. So the cell is the basic unit of life. Cells are very complex and dynamic. And here, I'm just showing you some images taken by fluorescence microscopy of various types of cells. But at any point in the talk, the biologists love jargon. If you see jargon that I don't explain, don't hesitate to ask me. These are pulmonary endothelial cells found basically in lung. And what we're seeing in terms of the light that you're seeing, this is fluorescence emission from specific proteins inside those cells that are tagged with a fluorescent probe, and then light is shone on it to excite fluorescence, which is then imaged. So you're seeing a spatial distribution of fluorescence emission from specific proteins inside these cells. These things are chick fibroblasts. These are a type of cell that we'll be showing later on. They're involved in wound healing. So if you cut yourself, you don't have to be a chicken to do this, but you may want to try it on a chicken. If you cut yourself, these types of fibroblast cells reside in the lower layers of the skin, in the dermis. And upon wound, they will become activated and crawl to the site of the wound, where they will differentiate and form new cell types. And you heard a bit about, in terms of the stem cell talk, about cell types changing and stuff like that.
What's the scale?
The scale? This is probably about 20 micrometers, roughly, across for the size scale. of a cell. I'll show some movies for migrating cells, which will have the space and time scales, but definitely a good question. The one, the chick fibroblast, you see the striation, those striated structures, that's labeling what's called the cytoskeleton. It's the sort of support and dynamic polymeric network inside the cell that actively regulates the movement of molecules inside the cell and also the mechanical properties of the cell. That scaffolding network, what is labeled there would be probably around 8 nanometers in diameter, but we're seeing with optical microscopy, so we see a diffraction with focus and stuff. But the underlying lines in that thing are really above 8 nanometer diameter polymeric filaments.
Are those two cells?
These are two cells, two adjacent cells in the fibroblast picture. One of the key things that I'm interested in doing is one thing that these pictures are missing. Basically, they're showing you a spatial distribution of these proteins at the time that those cells, in fact, those cells are dead. They were chemically fixed to be imaged in this state. Life itself is dynamic. It's a non-equilibrium process, so we're missing something here. We're missing the time component and missing the dynamics. And life being a dynamic non-equilibrium process, that's, I would say, a significant component to capture. So what I'm interested in doing is trying to look at the molecular choreography in cells, in time, in a way that goes beyond traditional approaches that have been taken in the past. And I would say a lot of work has been done in the past doing imaging, as was shown there, or with electron microscopy, static imaging of cells to see the structural relationships. But taking snapshots and looking statically, you can miss something. And you're trying to understand the rules of dynamic game from a series of static snapshots. And the analogy I often like to start up with is, let's compare this to hockey. I know we have visitors come from around the world, Perimeter Institute, and depending whether you understand hockey or not, I often choose this, and also it's great that we have the hockey stick.
It's a university.
Yeah. Could you understand hockey from a series of pictures? Now, hockey is a dynamic game, and if you took a series of snapshots, could you figure out the rules? Well, in terms of the analogy, this is the arena, so this is the cell. And inside the cell, we have various macromolecules which unfold dynamically in space and time. So if you're doing your traditional approach of static imaging inside the cell, and you take a picture, as a graduate student, you get happy that your experiment finally worked, and you bring it to your supervisor, and your supervisor, being omniscient and omnipotent, says, okay, Photoshop that artifact out of the image, and this is the key point that we're submitting to the journal. And so what is the exact meaning of that sequence? And of course, this is static, so easily filtered using Fourier techniques. Your competitor captures this and publishes on the cover of Nature or Science. It says this is the key aspect of the game. This is obvious central component. And then the competitive group gets the opposite, where the player is over the goaltender, and you battle it out in the literature. What are some of the key events in the game? Molecular interactions are very important, and we're interested in measuring interactions without concussions inside the cell. As well, if you're lucky in doing the static snapshots, you may capture one of these rare but significant events, but then your supervisor again tells you to Photoshop that artifact which keeps coming up in the images. If you're doing the static snapshot approach, you can easily miss rare or significant events. This doesn't happen often. This is a goaltender fight. So this is this is Patrick Waugh, who's a godlike in Montreal, and Chris Osgood for Detroit and when he was playing for Colorado. I play hockey. I've only been involved in a game once where there was a goaltender fight, and it was two goalies on my team fighting. The referee did not know what to do, and we just said, whoever wins gets to play. So. Or, this, my father goes on about this all the time, the 1972 summit series between the Soviet Union and Canada, and Paul Henderson's goal, he talks about 1972 all the time. It was a big year. And if you missed it, yeah, well, you know. You didn't see it unfold. Sometimes when we're imaging in cells, we see events or things that we cannot explain by any physical principles that we know. And sometimes it's best just to move on. In terms of the approaches that we take, it's easier to figure out the rules of the dynamic game if we can actually observe it unfolding in situ in the actual thing. So hockey is easier to figure out if you watch the dynamic game unfolding in space and time. On the right-hand side, I show the thing that is really the focus of the first part of this talk. I'm going to show you a movie of a migrating cell. The space scale across the entire image field is 170 micrometers for this fairly large cell. But to finish off the hockey analogy, I wanted, for those of you who are not necessarily Canadian, to show you hockey at what I would say is its lowest level as practiced at McGill University. This is D-League intramural hockey, and this is footage from the annual McGill chemistry versus physics game. That's me there, and I shamefully admit I played for chemistry. Chemistry had a D-League team. Physics did not when I joined the department. I wanted to get my hockey legs back when I started, and this leads to endless anguish. I do play soccer for physics, and I'm probably moving up to physics C. I'm going to start the movie up for the spatial scale. This is about a two meter scale, and this is real time. If we start the movie, yeah, there it goes. If we start it, I refer to this as the famous Bertuzzi incident. For those of you, so this is in between periods. Physics is in yellow, chemistry is in red. This is Patricia Davidson, who's captain of the physics team. If you watch carefully, a very traumatic incident is about to unfold. Did you see? The place was filled with physics fans. They were chanting at this point in time and stuff. And if you observe long enough, you can actually observe rare events occurring in these types of games. So I send this to my father to say, look, all that money on hockey lessons wasn't wasted. A rare event occurring in time. Let's look at what is more interesting, and this is actually migration of a cell in space and time. And what I'm showing here is a image time series of what is called a CHO cell. This is a Chinese hamster ovary cell. And it's just a type of migratory cell that, again, when it becomes active, will migrate in specific directions. And what are we seeing in this movie? We are actually using an evanescent wave to excite fluorescence at the boundary between the cell and its substrate, where it's forming adhesion structures. And I'm going to show you overviews, cartoons of how the biologists picture these things. But the thing to note is you see these bright red areas at the leading edge? That's where the cell is forming new macromolecular adhesion structures. It's aggregating all sorts of different proteins to form a spot weld. At the front of the cell, it's anchoring to the substrate. It's connecting to that polymeric cytoskeletal network, and there's motor proteins which are generating forces. All of this has to be integrated in space and time in order for the cell to generate forces and pull itself across the substrate. The green is another protein, alpha actinin, which is labeling, it binds to some of these cytoskeletal elements that I talked about. The level of this picture, or these movie, is typical of what the biologists can obtain now using various types of microscopy. Imaging in space and time. What we would like to do is to go beyond the movie and to say something quantitatively about what the macromolecules are doing inside these cells in terms of transport, clustering, aggregation properties. One of the challenges faced by this is that we are doing this in order to observe it dynamically. We have to use yes.
Is this under control of the nucleus?
What is in that particular one, the proteins which are expressed inside that cell are under the control of the nucleus. So the nucleus, when it needs more proteins expressed, will read the genetic code, synthesize new proteins. These will get positioned at the appropriate locations, for example, in the bottom of the cell to form these things.
So there's feedback from something in the...
There's feedback from the environment,
which
tells the cell that it needs to. And what I didn't tell you in that particular image The substrate on which that cell is located is coated in another protein called an extracellular matrix protein, which activates the start of the whole adhesion process. These cells also respond to, and I'm not going to talk about this, but they also respond to mechanical stresses and mechanical cues, which can lead to activation of protein synthesis and things like that. Some of the things we're trying to do is actually, I didn't put it in this talk, introduce mechanical forces and things to try to study some of those things. The cell I showed is basically responding to proteins in its environment, which are leading to activation and probably activating signaling cascades, which go over a couple hour periods. The dynamics that you saw unfold in that time loop were over a 50-minute time period. That is not necessarily being directed by the nucleus. That is being directed dynamically by motor proteins shuttling things around, a very complex physical chemical dance, which are some of the things we're trying to elucidate. I'm going to show you some of the aspects of the molecular mechanism, what they call the clutch mechanism, in analogy to a car, later on in the talk, using a vector mapping formalism to actually try to tease out some of the molecular details. So it operates on many different scales. At some level, the overall expression of proteins, how many, et cetera, is controlled through the nucleus. Other responses are responses of the cell to its specific environment.
But I guess my question was, there's then some signaling or feedback from the environment that's controlling the switches on the DNA against the protein expression?
Yes, in some way, yeah. Yeah.
Is that understood?
I'd say no, not entirely. I would say very complex, because there's amplification, and a lot of these proteins that are studied have actual areas where it's known that it will connect to some sort of signaling pathway inside the cell, and there's usually multiple pathways, and it looks like there's some crosstalk between different ones. Those are other things that we're trying to understand quantitatively in terms of these approaches. Not fully understood. In fact, I'd say right now, a lot of it's black box. This interacts with that. At least if you extract everything, do it in a test tube, it looks like everything's interacting with everything. We're trying to do it in situ and try to tease out some of these things. One of the challenges faced by this is, I showed you this is light microscopy. In order to observe it dynamically, light microscopy is one of the only ways we can approach it. However, nature hands us an optical resolution limit set by diffraction, so we are using a very rough ruler in terms of optical microscopy to observe these things, and of course the proteins themselves are on a 10 nanometer length scale. The other thing which is challenging is if you do this in actual, in real tissues, they're highly scattering for photons, so in the analogy of the hockey game, it would be like watching a hockey game through milk in terms of the scattering environment. So how do we get around some of these things? Well, one thing in that movie that I showed you is we are basically using fluorescence tagged specifically to proteins of interest in order to observe protein A, protein B, protein C. And that movie that I showed you was actually the proteins we were interested in were labeled with another protein called the green fluorescent protein. This is a protein found in jellyfish located off Washington State. It's about 4 nanometers by 3 nanometers in terms of dimensions. The chromophore is in the center of this sort of beta barrel structure. It is naturally fluorescent. You shine a laser of appropriate wavelength on it, you will emit fluorescence photons. This is what we're imaging. The people who figured this out came up with the brilliant idea is once they cloned the DNA code for this jellyfish protein, they said, it's naturally fluorescent, we have the code for it, let's write that code into the code for other proteins, and we'll generate a protein with a built-in light bulb. And that's what we're imaging in there. We are looking at specific proteins with a jellyfish protein that happens to glow when we shine a laser on it to mark position. As far as I know, I haven't seen anybody explain why jellyfish possesses a fluorescent protein. At least I haven't seen that explained yet. So that's one of the mysteries of nature. Some talk about it being involved in terms of surprising predators or things like that, but don't know. But we use it as a built-in label, a marker.
And is there an assumption that this doesn't mess up any of the other chemical pathways?
The very important assumption. So. Proteins are about 10 nanometer length scale. This is a portion of a protein itself, 4 by 3 nanometers. you can basically usually stick it at one end or the other end of the amino acid sequence for the protein. And it's going to be a lump sitting there, which could interfere with other binding events. Whenever the biologists design these constructs, they run a battery of controls to see if the natural function is messed up by this label. So the cell I'm showing there, in fact, tested. The biologists I work with in the US took a mutant which did not have adhesive properties. So the cell itself could not adhere because it was missing the protein machinery to do the adhesion. They expressed these constructs in the cell and got full adhesion. And also when you study by electron microscopy, structures look right. But you do have to really do those controls. And I've talked to people where they've designed these things and it's messed up natural function or blocked binding sites and things like that. So very important to definitely control.
How do you make sure that the protein only gets attached to one end of the amino acid sequence or the other rather than being stuck in the middle?
You target it specifically in terms of the genetic techniques. So you basically have it expressed at a specific site at one terminus or the other. So there are genetic techniques so that you can actually, usually various aspects are used to get these into cells, actually piggybacking on some of viral entry and stuff. So they will encode these in plasmids, and there will be a sequence which will say basically express this in a particular location. So in almost all the cases, and I'm not an expert because I'm not a molecular biologist, in almost all of the cases, most of the cases I've seen with these types of proteins, they are encoded at one end of the protein or the other end. I've seen a couple where they incorporate it in the middle and sort of snipped it in, but not. They use very specific strategies.
So is it something like taking a carrier that will pick out a specific DNA sequence and so bind to this here, and therefore you wind up with the for making that protein at the right point in the...
Yes. So in a normal DNA sequence for a protein, like there will be a stop code, and what they will do is directly target this thing into just before the stop code. Or likewise there's a start code, and they will have it actually snip or ligase so it fits into the just after the start code in terms of the thing.
And for the red ones, you have a different fluorescent protein?
Absolutely. It's the red one is from a coral. It's a naturally fluorescent protein from a coral, and it's a very difficult one to work with. The green, there are variations now on that one, which are yellow, cyan, blue. You get them in a variety of fluorescent colors. So it really is an advantage for live cell imaging, but you do have to watch out for these types of things. And there's new improvements on the red side as well.
How universal can be used for any class of cells?
It's fairly universal, but it depends on the cell type, how well the cells take it up. Neurons are trickier, so we're doing some things with neurons where it just spits it out, or the neurons die and things. It depends on the cell type, and when you actually do it, you will get a certain quote-unquote transfection efficiency. So you treat the cells, and across your entire plate, you will see, say you'll get a 5% transfection efficiency, you'll see 5% of the cells expressing the fluorescent protein, and the others will not. So there's a little bit more strategy to it. You also encode in doing this, a resistance gene to a specific antibiotic, and the cells that end up expressing it, you end up building in a resistance to a specific antibiotic, and then you treat your cells with the antibiotic, and you kill everything except the ones that express, and then you wait for them to divide up. So the molecular biologists were very clever in terms of the design strategies, because typically these divide a little bit slower than a natural cell type, so if you let it evolve in time, the regular cells would win out in the long run. So there's a variety of strategies. I don't do this myself, but I do have people in my lab, physicists, who are now doing the transfections and things like that. But I'm definitely not an expert, but it has actually allowed us to do quite a few things. In terms of the actual techniques that we're working on, these it's going from those image series and trying to examine fluctuations in these images to figure out what's actually happening at the molecular level. And the actual ideas, the fluctuation theory, of course, goes back to Einstein, Shmulkowski, Boltzmann, et cetera. Experimental implementations of this started to appear in the 1960s, and the technique on which the techniques I work on is based is called fluorescence correlation spectroscopy, developed at Cornell University in the early 1970s by Watt Webb, Elliot Elson, and Douglas Magee. And the idea behind fluorescence correlation spectroscopy is simply this. You take a microscope objective lens, take a laser, focus it down through the lens, and you, within the diffraction limit focus, you will have a certain size diffraction pattern in which your exciting intensity is located. And if you use a high power objective, this focal volume is about a cubic micrometer. It's sub-femtoliter in size. And as fluorescently tagged molecules move in and out of the focal volume, while they're in the focal volume, they will get excited by the laser, and you will get fluorescence emission, and when they exit, you no longer have emission. Doing this, you effectively reduce your observation system to a small enough size such that fluctuations become measurable and important. Thermodynamics argues that basically macroscopic thermodynamics works because we can ignore fluctuations for large-scale systems. 1/√n dependence, we can effectively neglect fluctuations in terms of molecules entering and leaving this room. However, if we shrink down our observation volume, we get to a size scale such that the numbers are such that the relative fluctuation becomes large enough to be measured, and it carries all of the information about kinetics and also number densities. So in the original FCS technique, they simply focused the laser, excited fluorescence, and collected a time series of fluorescence photons as a function of time from that small observation spot, and then characterized the fluctuations in that time series. And they did it by a first order temporal correlation function of that intensity of the fluctuation time series. They autocorrelated in time that series and looked at the decay of the correlation functions to give information on the dynamics. What we do is we have extended this to space and time by going to an imaging modality. And we use laser scanning microscopes, where this is just showing a femtosecond laser system, coming in through the same type of objective, where we focus on the sample, but instead of staying in one spot, we're using laser scanning microscope to raster the beam across the sample. So we are effectively, and again, you excite and collect the fluorescence back through the same objective through appropriate filters onto detectors. The movie that the biologists would collect on the same type of microscope, we view this as a matrix of intensity fluctuations in space and time, and perhaps wavelength if we use different color fluorophores. So from our perspective, this is now a matrix of space-time intensity fluctuations recorded from the system, and then we're going to do correlation in space and time to pull out information on what the fluorescently tagged molecules are doing. The movie I showed of the migrating cell was actually not done by laser scanning microscopy. It was done by evanescent wave imaging, where we basically totally internally reflect a laser beam off the interface with the specimen. So we bring the laser comes in beyond the critical angle, totally internally reflects, comes out, and we generate an evanescent wave at the boundary, which can excite fluorescence within about 100 nanometers due to the decay of the evanescent field. We get a very tight region at the boundary where we can excite fluorescence. And since all the adhesion is occurring at that boundary, that's what we really want to focus on. So we also use so-called evanescent wave microscopy. Biologists call it TIRF, total internal reflection fluorescence. So what types of things can we do with this? Well, if we have our image time series, we can do a spatial autocorrelation of the intensity fluctuations within individual images, calculate a normalized spatial intensity fluctuation autocorrelation function. So this is just an ensemble average across the image of fluctuations in pixel at one location with the intensity at pixel shifted in the two orthogonal directions within the image, and calculating the degree of correlation in space across an entire image, And then we normalized by the average intensity of the image squared. This basically, if you look at the central leg amplitude, that's the square relative fluctuation. So relative fluctuation will go as 1 over root n being the mean number of independent fluorescently labeled units in your focal volume. This is basically giving you the square relative fluctuation. So the amplitude of that function inversely scales with the mean number of fluorescent intensities in the focal volume. This gives us a way of measuring not only concentration of the fluorescent molecules inside the volume, but also changes in aggregation state. In biology, almost everything in terms of a dynamic unfolding involves sequential interactions of different things, aggregates forming, new things coming together. The ability to measure aggregation is a huge, huge thing. If we have a number of entities which are independent, all fluorescently labeled, and they aggregate to form a complex, we effectively change the n. And this spatial correlation function will increase in amplitude. We've used it to measure kinetics of aggregation events and disassembly inside cells if you repeat this calculation for each of the images. The near quadrant is a Gaussian fit function to this. It's Gaussian because we're using a TEM00 Gaussian laser beam in terms of the microscope. As well, we have time information encoded in the image series. And we can also do temporal correlation analogous to the FCS technique through the image stack. So we can correlate pixel to pixel and shift in time to calculate a normalized time correlation function where now we're doing lags in time in order to see what is the decay of the intensity fluctuations over time and average that for a specific number of pixels in a given region. The decay of the time correlation function, the shape and rate of decay will depend on the transport process. Diffusion, random diffusion, will decay in a different manner than if they're moving in a directed fashion. In terms of two-dimensional diffusion in a membrane, that will decay as a hyperbolic function. This is a measurement from an actual cell of pure two-dimensional membrane diffusion. So you can fit the decay of the correlation function to various transport modes and pull out diffusion coefficients, flow speeds. The flow comes out of the Gaussian decay, because you basically, if you consider the emitters as delta functions, and you have a Gaussian beam integrating over them, as they flow through the Gaussian beam, you're basically picking out the Gaussian nature of the excited beam. As well, the offset, if this correlation function does not decay to zero, it will indicate that we have a certain amount of the labeled protein immobile. And I highlight here that this time correlation, straight time correlation, gives us speed. It does not give us direction because we've encoded no spatial lags in this type of time correlation function. Next step up, we get the vectors. And that's what, after showing a few results on these older techniques, I'll show you the vector results. Just quickly as well, in biology, interactions are everything between sequentially. If we have a system in which we have different species interacting and changing space and time, we can image, if we can label the green and the red, the cyan and the yellow, we can image in two different detection channels and then do correlation in each channel, but we can also do cross-fluctuation, cross-correlation analysis. In principle, and you can do this in space, so spatial cross-correlation function between channel A and B, where we cross-correlate the fluctuations, or time cross-correlation between A and B. If the species that you're interested in are not interacting, they will not cross-correlate. You will not get an amplitude to your cross-correlation function. If they are interacting, you will be able to measure it with these types of approaches. Some results. Here's a movie again. This is again a CHO cell, similar to the same type of cell as was shown in the last movie. This is imaged by nonlinear microscopy. The signal is again fluorescence emission. This is a 7.5-minute time loop. The cell is again on a substrate which is activated. So there are proteins which are activating, actually probably creating signaling cascades within this cell. But this is on a shorter time scale than the cell, for example, would generate new proteins, etc. If you notice, this cell is not migrating, unlike the other one. And we see differences from the center of the cell to the periphery. You see, in the periphery, we have lamellar. These are lamellar extension. That's a microspike retraction. This cell isn't sure what it wants to do. It's sending out lamellar extensions, kind of exploring what the substrate is like in that direction, and then doesn't want to move, so it retracts and all this dynamically. This is probably alpha actin and bound actin filament bundles inside at the sort of the center of the cell. We do the time correlation in different regions. We can do the generate this time correlation function, and that's a 64 by 64 pixel subregion. Get a very high signal to noise measurement. That decay fits best to a basically three component process: a two dimensional diffusive population, a Gaussian for a flowing population, and the offset indicates there's a fraction of protein that's immobile. Diffusion coefficient is simply the characteristic diffusion time that we pull out of the fit. If we know the beam radius, the diffusion coefficient is basically the square of the beam radius divided by 4 times the characteristic diffusion time. Yep.
So there should be some notion of equilibrium when it comes to diffusion coefficients and decay processes and so on. So what exactly is the equilibrium reference point?
One basic assumption is that the cell is operating in steady state. And in terms of the transport processes, what one typically observes is at this spatial scale, it's a low Reynolds number environment. Okay, so all motion, if you are not driving it, then all motion is thermal based and diffusive based. If you observe directed components and we pick up a flow in that component, then there has to be a driving force in the low Reynolds number environment. So then there have to be motor proteins or some sort of bulk flow process which is carrying things along. In terms of the equilibrium reference point, et cetera, the cell itself is not at equilibrium. It's operating in some sort of living dynamic steady state. But in terms of the transport processes that we're observing, you observe one end of the scale either thermal driven in terms of the bath, or if you see motion, it's moved by motor proteins inside the cell.
Yeah, just how do you fit those parameters? I mean, how? There's one curve.
There's one curve, and the fit parameters are basically an amplitude parameter and characteristic time. So
those are all optimally adjusted?
Yes.
That one curve with a minimum chi-square?
Yes, a minimum chi-squared. And
So what confuses me is I can imagine lots of curves with 5 parameters that might fit that. So what signals out this?
What signals out this is it varies. What we typically do is we take a family of decays, of different decay models, we fit to them. In some cases, if the chi-squared is not, if there's not a significant difference, then we can't differentiate between the case. In terms of other models of families, typically what, in terms of transport, it's either going to be some sort of diffusive mechanism, or it's going to be a driven in these types of systems. So we know we're basically dealing with that. Other complications or folds you can put over that is confined diffusion, diffusion within confined zones, these types of things, which we also study. And I'll show you some single molecule measurements, which can tease out more details in that. But this multi-parameter fit is also important, and I'll show you in terms of when we actually use quantum dots as labels, because that's one of the things we're trying to do is reduce, in terms of fit models, things which actually simplify and are less model dependent in terms of the fitting. We supplement some of these measurements with single molecule measurements where we observe the trajectories of individual labeled species, and we can observe the thing as it moves within the cell and begin to see specifically on a particular time scale how the individuals are moving. And we supplement these types of measurements with
those. But I guess related to that, this is a curve from one hamster cell, right?
Yep.
So suppose I take another cell from the same hamster. If I repeat this, am I going to find AD and TD and all those things roughly the same?
I'll show you. Okay. There's the diffusion and flow, coefficient of flow speed and the mobile fraction for this particular section of that cell.
Of that one cell.
Of that one cell. If you measure across that cell, this is a transport map for that given cell. How do you read this? The circles represent root mean squared diffusion distance for the diffusion of protein in given regions, and the bars indicate fraction of the protein in different types of transport modes. And as you can see, this one cell for that 7.5 minute loop has much higher diffusion coefficients occurring in the periphery. And I have vectors in here. I'll show you where we get the vectors in a second. It changes, and it not only changes across a cell, it will change over different time periods for a given cell under stimulation and things like that. And we can show this. A cell at rest like this will behave very differently than a migrating cell. And I'll show you more dynamic transport measurements in these types of.
So that means these numbers really are, it's like maybe if we took everybody in this room and had them run a race, we could plot all the different speeds, but it's going to depend on each of us.
Yes.
It really is highly cell specific.
It's highly cell specific. It's specific to what the cell is doing. It's specific to stimulation of the cell, all of these things. We can do mock wound assays where we grow these cells up on a glass substrate, and they'll grow until they come into contact with each other, and so they'll just form a monolayer of cells. Then if you take a razor blade and you scrape across the field of cells and effectively cut a wound through a highway through the middle, the cells on the sides will sense that they no longer have neighbors, and they probably also chemically sense that there's damaged cells. They probably respond to a chemotactic gradient. They will polarize and begin migrating into the mock wound. And when they do that, you observe changes in the transport processes within the cells.
Is there a theory which predicts those measured values?
I'm part of NIH cell migration consortium, where it involves experimentalists from biology through physical science to theoretical people doing theory. There's a group who are trying to come up with theoretical models based on mechanical constraints, curvature of the cells, all of these things, feeding in the experimental measurements to try to come up with a predictive framework. It's in its infancy, but there are people making efforts. They've been able to reproduce some things, for example, in some of these cells where the adhesions form based on aspects of curvature, stresses, things like that, which are seen to be reproduced experimentally. But I'd say that type of stuff is in its infancy, but it's a direction as well that the field is moving. So if we return to this particular cell, and I just showed you diffusion coefficients, and I showed you a flow speed, and I showed you vectors, how can we pull out the dynamic information? I just wanted to sort of put this into context again in terms of the picture that the biologists have, and then relate it to the transport measurements that I'm about to show. So the cell that I showed is on a substrate. We have adhesion proteins in the membrane anchoring to proteins outside the cell. And you have anchoring the proteins which will anchor this to this polymeric cytoskeletal network, which move things where there are motor proteins moving things around dynamically. All of this has to be attached in order for the cell to generate force and actually migrate. And there's questions about, in this migrating cell, how is the protein initially, how does it form these new aggregates, and how is the force generated, and how are the proteins shuttled around? It's a low Reynolds number environment. Motion is diffusive, unless there's an actual force imparting a movement. And if you impart a movement, that means the cell has to expend energy. So if you want to move something in a directed fashion, you have to expend energy in order to do that. So not much was known about this type of thing, but we're trying to examine what's going on in these various regions. These are just types of words that the biologists throw around. What I'm going to show you is lamellipodium is just the leading edge of migrating cell. So as the cell moves in a particular direction, that lamellipodium is the very front of the cell. lamellar region is the one behind it, and then we have the rear. I refer to them as front and rear of the cell, respectively, for different zones. In terms of the actual picture, you asked about what's activating these things. There is extracellular matrix proteins which are on the substrate that we've coated, and we're actually patterning these in terms of geometric patterns and densities to try to tease out some of these details. They bind to integrin proteins in the membrane. For a size scale, the membrane of the cell is 5 nanometers in thickness, and the polymeric cytoskeletal elements are located throughout the cell, and then you have all this architecture. And I asked the biologist why would it be built with so much stuff, but apparently all of these things have a role in terms of connecting or signaling. This one, this guy, FAC, that's a signaling molecule. Once the aggregation occurs, it is believed to be recruited and lead to activation of some of those signaling cascades that we talked about earlier. The overall picture is that ultimately, if you connect extracellular, cellular Velcro, I call the integrins, the adhesion proteins, and the cytoskeletal elements, motor proteins move the cytoskeletal elements along, which ends up generating forces in terms of the migration, the overall migration of these cells. If the connection is broken somewhere, then the cell cannot generate forces in order to migrate. So the biologists refer to what they call the molecular clutch, that there is some sort of molecular regulation of the connection between all of these things to engage or disengage, like the clutch in a car. So the latest thing we've been doing is extending the measurements to full space-time correlation, where we correlate through an image series in space and time. And here is spatial correlation as a function of time. The central decay value is basically the time correlation function at zero lag that we looked at before. If we take the spatial correlation function over time through a series, if we have a flow component, we will see basically it will correlate in space in a given direction, and we will see the peak evolve in the given direction. That's where we can get the vector out from. The central peak is the Brownian population. So you can see that decay and spread on a tracer diffusion experiment. And we can basically also see, in this type of measurement, the two populations emerging as well, and actually cross-compare the two types of measurements, in addition to the single molecule measurements. If we do that, we can image in different regions of cells. And I'm going to show you image analysis from the second region of cell. Here is the contour plot of the space-time correlation function for the region of the cell that I showed on the right. And basically, you just see a blob. And there's dynamic information under there, but what the problem is, a lot of the proteins we're looking at are locked in complexes and not moving. So they spatially correlate at the same place in time and dominate our space-time correlation function. However, if we filter the zero-frequency component in Fourier space, we can pull out the components due to the dynamic process. So once we remove the zero-frequency component, we get this. And you can see the peak evolving in space and time, and we can get the vector out. The other that we showed, the time correlation function, is this one. And again, you asked before, we fit to a diffusion flow model. For this decay fit best to a diffusion flow model. In the space-time correlation function, you can see the residual peak due to the Brownian, and you can see the peak coming off due to the flow. So we can do the two separately, which also gives some indication that we're seeing these processes as well. We expect these two ends of the game to occur inside the cell. So some of the latest results. Same type of no, this is a different type of cell. This is a mouse cell. Mouse embryonic fibroblast. Also, it's involved a wound healing type cell. This cell is idling. It's sitting. It's not migrating. But if you look, the protein that we're labeling is alpha actinin. It binds to these cytoskeletal polymeric elements inside the cell. Can you kind of make out that there's movement toward the center of the cell if you look carefully? What you're seeing there is retrograde movement of those cytoskeletal elements. In the idling cell, the motor proteins are pulling those cables back towards the center of the cell, and it's just kind of a motor idling. If it's not engaged to the adhesion machinery, it's not generating force. So they're just pulling them back, continuing to pull them back, and the actinin protein that we have labeled binds to those elements. So you can see it in this cell. Half the time, you cannot make it out. But if you do the space-time correlation, this is what you get. You see this is accelerated 40 times. You see the movement of the peak off in a particular direction. You can actually pull out the vectors of the movement in this type of cell. Doing that, you can get a detailed vector map now of the movement of this protein in migrating and non-migrating cells. In the migrating cell, we have to actually correct for the cell frame of reference from the molecular frame of reference. So we correlate the overall cell with itself, and we can pull out the direction of the cell migration, which is on a particular slow time scale. And you can basically see very detailed vector maps, and this is a map of retrograde flow of that protein in the idling cell. I won't talk about that inverse relationship, it just reproduces what others have shown for the actual actin inside these cells. The next thing that we did is all of these proteins are somehow interconnected. So we did the two-color experiments, where we labeled the actin, which we know the cell is moving, and protein of interest, signaling proteins, adhesion proteins, etc. So actin is labeled with our red coral fluorophore, and various other proteins are labeled with our green label. Integrin is the adhesion protein. FACT, that's a signaling protein. Actinin binds to the actin. They all supposedly do different things. We imaged both at the same time, and we did vector maps across the cells. And we correlated, basically, the vector field in green for one protein against the actin, because the actin, we know, is what's being moved by the motor proteins. So we cross-correlated each individual vector in terms of magnitude and direction. And this is what the vector fields look like. Actin in a cell against a protein called paxillin, actin against focal adhesion kinase FACT, actin against TALEN. Correlate the two vector fields. And here's the results. This is average for a given sample for a type of fibroblast cell. At one end of the scale, we're correlating the relative magnitude of the vector fields for direction and magnitude versus actin. So these are all scores versus against the actin, which we know is moving. At one end, the integrin correlates very poorly with the actin. And that's not surprising, because the integrin is in the membrane anchoring the cell to the substrate. The actin itself is being moved around inside the given cell. And so we don't expect necessarily that those two correlate, certainly in the idling cell. The other end of the spectrum, the actinin, which binds to actin, it correlates perfectly. And everything, the other ones we measured, came at a 70% level. We actually think that these are part of the clutch mechanism coming on and off the regulating the adhesion. That they're coming on and off. When they're on, they correlate with the movement of the actin. When they come off, you lose the correlation. And we see this across these cell types. So we believe that these are all part of the complex which regulates the adhesion clutch. And this basically shows you can treat the cells with drugs which disrupt all of the motions, and you totally change the vector fields and the transport inside the cells. And that's, again, different drug treatments. So we basically have pulled from these types of studies, it looks like there are two levels of connection at which the cell regulates the clutch mechanism in these cells. And ultimately, the adhesion is only driven when the cytoskeleton is connected to the integrin, which is connected to the substrate. Otherwise, you just have the cytoskeletal elements idling in a retrograde fashion inside these cells. I just will show you a highlight of quantum dots, nanoparticles, and I won't go into the nonlinear microscopy and things, because I don't know if this is of interest, But I think nanoparticles are somewhat cool. So I'll just discuss that. This, what I showed already, these are the genetically encoded fluorescent proteins. We are also using nanoparticles for these types of measurements. And we're using, for example, cadmium selenide zinc sulfide quantum dots, which are below 10 nanometers in length scale. The nanoparticles are very interesting because they have size-dependent emission, and they can be functionalized to attach specifically to systems of interest. For example, we're very interested in understanding how neurons form new synaptic connections to encode memories. This is showing a three-dimensional reconstruction of a neuron that I imaged back in San Diego. And these are dendrites. You see this knobby structure on the dendrites? These are things called dendritic spines. Those are micrometer-long projections. They are the site of excitatory synapses. So the synapse in terms of connection between different neurons. For excitatory synapses, they seem to be on these micrometer-long projections called spines. And there's a lot of interest in understanding how molecules are moved, proteins are moved in and out of the synapses to regulate memory and encode memories. One of the things that we're doing with neuroscientists at Laval University is tagging proteins that are involved in this process with quantum dot nanoparticles, which emit light, and then basically following these in time. The idea is basically like looking at skiers going down a slope at night with the torches. You can't see the individual skiers, but you can see where they're skiing based on the emission of light. And we can do this on a single quantum dot level. So this is imaging. This is a tissue slice of neurons. See the black lines? Those are those dendrites. The green is marking, the fluorescence marking where the synapses should be located, and the red are quantum dots attached to AMPA receptors, which are involved in chronic pain, which are found in the dendrites and are believed to shuttle into synaptic regions upon stimulation. And if you, so there you have the AMPA receptor with a quantum dot attached, and then it supposedly traffics into synapses. If you do have single molecule level, again, the green is showing where the synapse is located, you can basically image the trajectory of the AMPA receptor with the quantum dot attached, and we're imaging the quantum dot as it moves around the dendrite, and wanting to understand quantitatively, is it randomly going into the synapse, or is it actually undergoing confinement, looking at the mean squared displacement over time, analyzing, is it a true random walk, is it doing what the biologists think it's doing upon stimulation. So this is a single molecule measurement. And we are, yes?
Can you point to the quantum dot?
Sorry, how did, sorry?
Why do you use the name quantum dot?
They use the name quantum dot because basically the emission properties of the nanoparticle are different than the bulk semiconductor. So if you shrink down below the Bohr exotonic radius, you basically get, you go from a bulk optical properties to more like an atomic system with separated levels. So they call it a quantum dot because they are basically exhibiting quantum confinement in terms of the Bohr radius, the Bohr exotonic radius is basically confined within the size of the small nanoparticle.
So this is the same quantum dot that condensed matter people are using for experiments in doing.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And I see that in terms of the time is 3 o'clock, so I'm just going to leave you with a problem that these quantum dots, why use the nanoparticles? They do not bleach out. The fluorescent probes I showed you before, if you image them over time, they will emit a certain number of times and turn off. The nanoparticles emit for very long periods of time without bleaching. But they also blink. They blink on and off, and the blinking is not a single exponential behavior, it's power law. So one quantum dot will turn on and off for time at different time scales that are distributed as a power law in time. papers are, people are studying this effect in terms of what's going on in terms of surface trap states, et cetera, and different models are being proposed. It's still not fully understood why, what is the physical mechanism of the blinking process. But the techniques that I showed you, and I'm just going to finish off at this point in time, which are based on measuring fluctuations. Obviously, this blinking procedure is another fluctuation thrown on top of the transport fluctuations, which would add another component to the fitting. We've done an approach where we go to reciprocal space in the images, which separates all of this photophysics from the transport fluctuations, which allows us to reduce the number of parameters in terms of our fit and clean up the photophysics. Just want to, we'll finish off there. I won't talk about the nonlinear microscopy aspects. Some of the things that we're looking at in terms of conclusion, measuring these transport properties within and mapping in cells and different cells, different stimulation conditions across cells and populations of cells, but also doing it in terms of under controlled environments. You asked about signaling before. The thing we did these on, we just randomly coded with a protein. We are trying to use various techniques where we can pattern proteins and define geometric patterns in defined concentrations, in gradients, et cetera, to generate an environment in which we know the concentration of the things which are activating the processes, putting the cells in these types of things, including neurons, and doing these under control experiments. The reciprocal space technique was what I just referred to in terms of that we get to talk about. We're also looking at neurons, how they grow out in contact with other types of neurons. I'd like to acknowledge Rick Horowitz and Claire Brown, University of Virginia, who provided the cells that I showed and are collaborators on this cell migration consortium. Ben Hebert, Dave Colin, John Belil, and Richard Node in my group, who worked with the vector mapping and the reciprocal space technique and the quantum dots, Dr. Santiago Costantino, postdoc, David Ronis, a theorist in chemistry at McGill on the reciprocal space technique. Of course, funding agencies, but wanted to really show the people who did the work, Ben, Santiago, John, David, and don't have Richard in this thing. And this is an example of what we're doing in terms of defined patterning of proteins and fluorescent proteins. We can generate patterns. The original pattern was Diego Maradona. It's the postdoc was Argentinian. And the German postdoc argued that Einstein had a bigger footprint. So that's what we have there. I'd like to thank you for listening today. And if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to. And yeah, we can do fluorescent tattoos for ants, but this nonlinear optical.
So are you going to have to choose always between blinking and bleaching?
Yeah, in some, it, well, one thing
that's
I...
That's a necessary trade-off?
Somewhat. One thing I didn't show on the nonlinear optical techniques, we have... We are also doing approaches which are non-fluorescent, which are using nonlinear optical techniques where within the focus of the femtosecond laser, you are driving a nonlinear response of the thing we're looking at. These nonlinear responses can be non-bleaching. So one of the things we're looking at is harmonic optical generation. And this is an image of gold nanoparticles where it's third harmonic emission from the gold nanoparticles. This is non-blinking, non-bleaching, and that's 40 nanometer nanoparticles. We've done it for 20. We're trying to see how small we can go in the nanoparticle to generate the emission. Trick then becomes how do you tag that to your protein of interest. With the quantum dots and the regular fluorophores, yes, the trade-off is usually between stability, photostability, versus the blinking. linking of the thing. But some of these other nonlinear approaches do have chance to do similar types of imaging without blinking or bleaching and imaging for long periods of time.
Yeah. So the first set of experiments, you have a single cell substrate that you prepared.
Mm-hmm.
But presumably, in the real world, you have cells interacting with each other.
Absolutely.
With a lot of signaling and feedback going on between the cells.
Yes.
So how do you know that the things that you're seeing are significant for actual interactions when there are many cells in interaction?
A very important question, actually. What we're doing, as you said, is an artificial two-dimensional tissue culture with one type of cell at a certain density in an artificial environment. It is known, in fact, that in the actual tissues, these cells take on a different geometric shape. These ones look like if you took an egg, cracked it, put it in the frying pan, it spreads out and forms a thing. In the actual tissues, they're more sort of cylindrically elongated within a tissue environment. What we're moving to do is, tissue matrices, where we generate collagen matrices with pore sizes, et cetera, typical of what are found in tissues, seeding with various types of cells, and looking at the cells within a three-dimensional context, which is closer to the real state. The other thing that we can do with the nonlinear microscopies is, because it uses infrared femtosecond lasers, we can image within the tissues themselves and image the cells in situ in actual natural tissue. And you can generate transgenic mice which express the fluorescent proteins and look at them under that context. So that is also being done with the cell migration consortium. Much more difficult experiments, naturally, to pull off, especially if you have a live animal there. Along the neuroscience side, what we do is also, if we take the neurons, we'll do so-called sliced, where you will get an actual slice of the nervous tissue, which includes all the different cell types within a certain thickness, and we can again image using the nonlinear microscopies within the tissue. But the context is important, and I'd say they do some of the things similarly. Other things are missing this context of all the cross signaling and things like that. So we're moving in that direction.
Well, there are no more questions during the talk, so let's thank all the
These are full nanoparticles on the glass.